handsome. Even Sam noticed that. He had dark hair and dark eyes, not much different from Sam himself. But this boy's face seemed to glow with an inner light. He radiated confidence, but without arrogance or condescension. In fact, he managed to seem genuinely humble, even while standing alone, looking out over everyone else.
"Hi, everyone," he said. "I'm Kane Sorin. You probably figured out that we are from Coates Academy. Either that or we all just have the same bad taste in clothing."
There was a bit of a laugh from the crowd. "A self-deprecating joke to loosen us up," Astrid said, continuing her whispered commentary. Out of the corner of his eye, Sam noticed Mallet. The boy was turning away, crouching down, acting like he was trying to hide. Mallet was a Coates kid. What was it he'd said? That he didn't get along with the kids at Coates? Something like that.
"I know there's a tradition of rivalry between the kids of Coates Academy and the kids of Perdido Beach," Kane said. "Well, that was the old days. It looks to me like we're all in this together. We all have the same problems now, and we should work together to deal with our problems. Don't you think?"
Heads were nodding in response. His voice was clear, and just a little higher maybe than Sam's, but strong and determined. He had a way of looking at the crowd before him that made it seem he was meeting every person's eye, seeing every person as an individual.
"Do you know what happened?" a voice asked.
Kane shook his head.
"No, I don't think we probably know any more than you. Everyone 15 and over disappeared. And there's the wall, the barrier." "We call it the phase," Howard said loudly.
"The phase?"
Kane appeared interested.
"F-A-Y-Z. Fallout Alley Youth Zone."
Kane considered that for a moment, then laughed.
"That's excellent. Did you come up with that?"
"Yeah.
It's vital to keep a sense of humor when the world seems to have suddenly become a very strange place. What's your name?"
"Howard. I'm the captain's number one guy. Captain Orc."
An uneasy ripple moved through the crowd. Kane read it instantly.
"I hope you and Captain Orc will join me, and anyone else who wants to sit down and talk about our plans for the future. Because we do have a plan for the future."
He emphasized this last sentence with a chopping motion, like he was cutting away the past.
"I want my mom!"
a little boy cried out suddenly. Every voice fell silent. The boy had said what they were all feeling. Kane hopped down from the car and went to the boy. He knelt down and took the boy's hands in his own. He asked the boy's name and reintroduced himself.
"We all want our parents back," he said gently, but loudly enough to be overheard clearly by those nearest. "We all want that. And I believe that will happen. I believe we will see all our moms and dads and older brothers and sisters and even our teachers again. I believe that. Do you believe it too?"
"Yes,"
the little boy sobbed. Kane wrapped him in a hug and said,
"Be strong. Be your mommy's strong little boy."
"He's good," Astrid said. "He's beyond good."
Then Kane stood up. People had formed a circle around him, close but respectful.
"We all have to be strong. We all have to get through this. If we work together to choose good leaders and do the right thing, we will make it."
The entire crowd of kids seemed to stand a little taller. There were determined looks on faces that had been weary and frightened. Sam was mesmerized by the performance. In just a few minutes' time, Kane had infused hope into a very frightened, dispirited bunch of kids. Astrid seemed mesmerized, too, though Sam thought he detected the cool glint of skepticism in her eyes. Sam was skeptical himself. He distrusted rehearsed displays. He distrusted charm. But it was hard not to think that Kane was at least trying to reach out to the Perdido Beach kids. It was hard not to believe in him, at least a little. And if Kane really did have a plan, wouldn't that be a good thing? No one else seemed to have a clue. Kane raised his voice again.
If it's okay with everyone here, I would like to borrow your church. I would like to sit down with your leaders in the presence of our Lord and discuss my plan and any changes you want to make. Are there maybe, oh, a dozen people who could speak for you?
Me,
Ork said, shouldering his way forward. He still carried his aluminum baseball bat. And he had acquired a policeman's helmet, one of the black plastic helmets the Perdido Beach cops used when they patrolled on bicycles. Kane fixed the thug with a penetrating stare.
You must be Captain Ork.
Yeah, that's me.
Kane stuck out his hand.
I'm honored to meet you, Captain.
Ork's mouth dropped open. He hesitated. Sam thought it was probably the first time in Ork's turbulent life that anyone had said they were honored to meet him, and probably the first time anyone had offered to shake his hand. Ork was clearly confused. He glanced at Howard. Howard was looking from Ork to Kane, sizing up the situation.
He's paying you props, Captain,
Howard said. Ork grunted, shifted the bat from right hand to left, and stuck out his thick paw. Kane grabbed it with both his hands and solemnly looked Ork in the eye as they shook hands.
Smooth, Astrid said under her breath.
Still holding Ork's hand in his, Kane challenged,
Now, who else speaks for Perdido Beach?
Bouncing Bet said,
Sam Temple here went into a burning building to rescue a little girl. He can speak for me anyway.
There was a murmur of agreement.
Yeah, Sam is a hero for real,
a voice said.
He could have died, another voice seconded.
Yeah, Sam's the guy.
Kane's smile came and disappeared so quickly, Sam wasn't sure it had happened. For that millisecond, it was a look of triumph. Kane walked straight up to Sam, open and forthright, hand extended.
There are probably better people than me, Sam said, backing away.
But Kane grabbed his elbow and maneuvered him into a handshake.
Sam, is it? It sounds like you truly are a hero. Are you related to our school nurse, Connie Temple?
She's my mother.
I'm not surprised that she would have a brave son, Kane said with deep feeling. She's a very good woman. I see you're humble as well as brave, Sam, but I'm asking for your help. I need your help.
With the mention of his mother, everything fell into place. Kane. C. What were the odds that C was some other kid from Coates?
Sooner or later, C or one of the others will do something serious. Someone will get hurt. Just like S with T.
Okay, Sam said. If that's what people want. A few other names were mentioned, and Sam, half-heartedly, but loyally, named Quinn. Kane's eyes flickered from Sam to Quinn, and for just a millisecond there flashed a cynical, knowing look. But it was gone in a heartbeat, replaced by Kane's practiced expression of humility and resolve.
Then let's go in together, Kane said.
he turned and marched purposefully up the church steps. The rest of the Chosen fell in behind him. One of the Coates kids, a dark-eyed, very beautiful girl, waylaid Sam and held out her hand. Sam took it.
"I'm Diana," she said, not letting his hand go. "Diana Ladris."
"Sam Temple." Her midnight eyes met his, and he wanted to look away, feeling awkward, but somehow could not.
"Ah,"
she said, as if someone had told her something fascinating. Then she let him go and smirked.
"Well, well. I guess we better go in. We don't want to leave Fearless Leader without followers."
It was a Catholic church, built 100 years earlier by the rich man who had owned the cannery that now lay rusting and abandoned, a tin-plated eyesore by the marina. With soaring arches, half a dozen statues of saints, and wonderful, well-worn wooden pews, the church was much grander than the small town of Perdido Beach probably deserved. Of the 6 tall, peaked windows, 3 retained their original stained glass representations of Jesus in various parables. The other 3 had been lost over time to vandals or weather or earthquakes, and had been replaced with cheaper, abstract patterned stained glass. When Astrid entered the church, she dipped to one knee and made the sign of the cross while looking up at the intimidatingly large crucifix above the altar.
"Is this where you go to church?"
Sam asked in a whisper.
"Yes. You?"
He shook his head. It was Sam's first time inside. His mother was a non-observant Jew. No one spoke about what his father was, and Sam himself had only a vague interest in religion. The church made him feel small and definitely out of place. Cain had moved confidently toward the altar. The altar itself was not very grand, just a pale marble rectangle up 3 maroon-carpeted steps. Cain did not go to the old-fashioned raised pulpit, but stood on the 2nd of the 3 steps. In all, 15 kids were there, including Sam Temple, Quinn, Astrid, and Little Pete, Albert Hillsborough, and Mary Terrafino. Elwood Booker, the best 9th-grade athlete, and his girlfriend Dara Beidou. Ork, whose real name was rumored to be Charles Merriman. Howard Bassam, and Cookie, whose real name was Tony Gilder. From Coates Academy, in addition to Cain Soren, there was Drake Merwin, a smiling, playful, mean-eyed kid with shaggy, sandy-colored hair, Diana Ladris, and a lost-looking 5th-grader with big glasses and a blonde bedhead, introduced by Cain as Computer Jack. All of the Perdido Beach kids sat in pews, with Ork and his crew sprawling across the front pew. Computer Jack sat down as far to one side as he could. Drake Merwin stood, smirking, arms across his chest, on Cain's left, and Diana Ladris watched the crowd from Cain's right. It was again brought home to Sam that the Coates kids had rehearsed everything about this morning, from the staged motorcade, which must have taken hours of driving practice to master, to this presentation. They must have started planning and practicing right after the phase came. That was a troubling thought. After all the introductions were done, Cain moved briskly to explain his plan.
"We need to work together," he announced. "I think we should organize so that things aren't destroyed and problems can be handled. I think our goal should be to maintain, so that once the barrier comes down and once the disappeared people come back, they will find that we've done a pretty darn good job of keeping things together."
"The captain is already maintaining," Howard said.
"He's obviously done an excellent job,"
Kane allowed, walking down the steps and toward Ork as he spoke.
But it's a burden. Why should Captain Ork have to do all the work? I think we need a system, and I think we need a plan. Captain Ork, he addressed the thug directly, I'm sure you don't want to have to allocate food and care for the sick and keep the daycare functioning, and read all the things you'd have to read, and write all the things you'd have to write in order to establish a system here in Perdido Beach.
Astrid whispered, he's guessed that Ork is nearly illiterate.
Ork glanced at Howard, who seemed mesmerized by Kane. Ork shrugged. As Astrid said, the mention of reading and writing made him uncomfortable.
Exactly,
Kane said, as though Ork's shrug signified agreement. He returned to center stage and addressed the entire group.
We seem to have a reliable source of electricity, but communication is down. My friend Computer Jack thinks we can get the cell phones up and running.
There was an excited murmur, and Kane raised his hands.
I don't mean that we'll be able to call anyone outside of... what was Howard's brilliant term? The phase? But we would at least be able to communicate among ourselves.
Eyes swiveled to Computer Jack, who gulped and bobbed his head yes, and pushed his glasses up and blushed.
It will take time, but together we can do it,
Kane said. He emphasized his certainty by smacking his closed right fist into his left palm.
In addition to a sheriff to sort of make sure the rules are being followed, a job that I think Drake Merwin is qualified to do since his father is a highway patrol lieutenant, we'll need a fire chief to handle emergencies, and I nominate Sam Temple. Based on what people said earlier about his brave actions in that fire, I think he's an obvious choice, don't you?
There were nodded heads and murmurs of agreement.
He's co-opting you,
Astrid whispered.
He knows you're his competition. You don't trust him,
Sam whispered back. It was not a question.
He's a manipulator,
Astrid said.
Doesn't mean he's bad. He may be okay.
Mary said,
Sam saved the hardware store and the daycare, and he almost saved that little girl. Speaking of which, someone needs to bury her.
Exactly, Kane said. God willing, we won't have to face that need again, but someone has to bury the dead. Just as someone needs to help people who get sick or hurt. And someone needs to take care of the little children.
Dara Beidou spoke up and said,
Mary has totally been taking care of the preschoolers,
she explained.
Her and her brother John.
But we need help,
Mary said quickly.
We're not getting any sleep. We're out of diapers and food and...
She sighed.
Everything. John and I know the kids now, and we can keep running things, but we need help. We need a lot of help.
Kane seemed to mist up, almost as if he might shed a tear. He walked quickly to Mary, drew her to her feet, and put his arm around her.
What a noble person you are, Mary. You and your brother will be given the power to draft... How many people will it take to care for the Prees?
Mary calculated in her head.
The two of us and four others, maybe?
She said. Then, gaining confidence, she said,
Actually, we need four in the morning and four in the afternoon and four at night. And we need diapers and formula. And we need to be able to ask people to get us stuff, like food.
Kane nodded.
The young ones are our greatest responsibility. Mary and John, you have absolute authority to draft whatever people you need and demand whatever supplies you need. If anyone argues, Drake and his people, including Captain Ork, will make sure you get what you need.
Mary looked overwhelmed and grateful. Howard did not.
Say what now? I let it go by before, but are you saying Ork works for this guy?
He jerked a thumb at Drake, who just smiled like a shark.
We don't work for anyone. K Captain Ork doesn't work for anyone or under anyone or follow anyone's orders.
Sam saw a coldly furious expression appear on Kane's handsome face, then disappear as swiftly as it had come. Ork must have seen it too, because he stood up, and Cookie along with him. Both clutched bats. Drake, still smiling, stepped between them and Kane. A fight was coming, sudden as a tornado. Diana Ladris, oddly, was eyeing Sam closely, as if unconcerned by Ork. Kane sighed, raised his hands, and used both palms to smooth back his hair. There came a rumble, up through the floor in the pews. A small earthquake, minor. Nothing that Sam, like most Californians, hadn't felt before. Everyone jumped to their feet. Everyone knew what you did in an earthquake. But then came a rending sound. Steel and wood twisting, and the crucifix separated from the wall. It ripped free of the bolts holding it in place, like an invisible giant had yanked it away. No one moved. A shower of plaster and pebbles fell on the altar. The crucifix toppled forward. It fell like a chainsawed tree. As it fell, Kane dropped his hands to his sides. His face was grim, hard, and angry. The crucifix, at least a dozen feet tall, slammed with shocking force down onto the front row pew. The impact was as loud and sudden as a car wreck. Ork and Howard jumped aside. Cookie was too slow. The horizontal bar of the cross caught his right shoulder. He was on the ground, and a red stain was spreading. It all happened in the space of a few heartbeats, so fast that the kids who'd leapt to their feet didn't have the chance to bolt.
"Help me! Help me!"
Cookie cried. He lay bellowing on the floor. Blood was seeping through the fabric of his t-shirt. It pooled on the tile floor. Elwood shoved the cross off him, and Cookie screamed. Kane had not moved. Drake Merwin kept his cold gaze on Ork, his arms still crossed, seemingly indifferent. Diana Ladris maintained her focus on Sam. The knowing smirk on her face didn't waver. Astrid grabbed Sam's arm and whispered,
"Let's get out of here. We have to talk."
Diana saw that as well.
Help me! Oh man, I'm hurt!"
Cookie cried. Ork and Howard made no move to help their fallen comrade. Kane, perfectly calm, said,
"This is terrible. Does anyone know first aid? Sam, your mother was a nurse."
Little Pete, who had sat silent and still as a stone, began to rock faster and faster. His hands flapped as if he were warding off an attack of bees.
"I have to get him out of here. He's spiraling," Astrid said, and bundled Little Pete away. "Window seat, Petey. Window seat."
"I'm not a nurse," Sam blurted. "I don't know."
It was Dara Beidou who broke from her stunned trance to kneel beside the thrashing, bellowing Cookie.
"I know some first aid. Elwood, help me."
"I guess we have our new nurse," Kane said,
sounding no more agitated or concerned than the school principal announcing a name for the honor roll. Diana turned away, drifted past Kane, and whispered something in his ear. Kane's dark eyes swept across the shocked kids, seeming to size them up in turn. He formed a bare smile and nodded imperceptibly to Diana.
This meeting is adjourned till we can help our wounded friend. What is his name? Cookie?
Cookie's voice was even more urgent, demanding help, edging toward hysteria.
It really hurts. It really hurts bad. Oh, God.
Kane led Drake and Diana down the aisle, past Sam, following Astrid and Little Pete from the church. Drake paused halfway, turned back, and spoke for the first time. In an amused voice, he said,
"Oh, Captain Orc, have your people, the ones who aren't injured, line up outside. We'll work out your, duties."
With a grin that was almost a snarl, Drake added a cheerful,
"Later."
15. 251 hours, 32 minutes. Jack was slow to realize that he should follow Kane and the rest out of the church. He jumped up too suddenly and banged into the pew, making a noise that drew the attention of the quiet boy Kane had called a hero.
"Sorry,"
Jack said. Jack walked quickly outside. At first, he couldn't see any of the other Coates kids. A lot of people were outside the church, milling around, talking about what had happened inside. Cookie's cries of pain were only slightly muffled. Jack spotted the tall blonde girl he'd seen inside, and her little brother.
"Excuse me, do you know where Kane and everybody went?"
The girl, he didn't remember her name, looked him in the eye.
"He's in the town hall. Where else would our new leader be?"
Jack often missed nuance when people talked, but he didn't miss her cold sarcasm.
"Sorry to bother you."
He pushed his glasses back up on his nose and tried to smile at the same time. He bobbed his head and looked around for the town hall.
"It's right there," the girl pointed.
Then she said,
"My name is Astrid. Do you really think you can get the phones working?"
"Sure. It will take time, though. Right now the signal goes from your phone to the tower, right?"
His tone was condescending, and he formed his hands into a schematic of a tower with beams radiating toward it.
"Then it gets sent to a satellite, then down to a router, but we can't send the signals to the satellite now, so..."
He was interrupted by a shockingly loud cry of pain from inside the church. It made him flinch.
"How do you know we can't reach a satellite?"
Astrid asked. He blinked in surprise and made the smug face he made whenever someone questioned his technological expertise.
"I doubt you would understand."
Astrid said,
"Try me, kid."
To Jack's surprise, she seemed to follow everything he said. So he went on to explain how he could reprogram a few good desktop computers to serve as a primitive router for the phone system.
"It wouldn't be fast. I mean, it couldn't handle more than, say, a dozen calls simultaneously, but it should work at a basic level."
Astrid's little brother seemed to be staring at Jack's hands, which he was now twisting nervously. Jack was anxious being away from Kane. Before they had come down from Coates Academy, Drake Merwin had warned everyone that they should keep talk with the Perdido Beach kids to a minimum. A warning from Drake was serious.
"Well, I better go,"
Jack said. Astrid stopped him.
"So you're into computers?"
"Yeah, I'm kind of a tech guy."
"How old are you?"
12.
"That's young to have those skills."
He laughed dismissively.
"Nothing I've been talking about is hard to do. It's not something most people could do, but it's not hard for me."
Jack had never been shy when it came to his tech skills. He'd gotten his first real computer for his fourth Christmas. His parents still told the story of how he had spent 14 hours on the machine that first day, pausing only for Nutrigrain bars and juice boxes. By the time he was 5, he could easily install programs and navigate the web. By age 6, his parents were turning to him for computer help. By 8, he had his own website and was acting as his school's unofficial tech support. At 9, Jack had hacked into the computer system of his local police department to erase a speeding ticket for a friend's father. His own parents found out and panicked. The next semester, he was at Coates Academy, which was known as a place to send smart, difficult children. But Jack wasn't difficult, and he resented it. In any case, it didn't help him stay out of trouble. On the contrary, there were kids at Coates whom Jack's parents would have called bad influences. Some of them very bad influences. And some were just bad.
"So, what would be hard for you, Jack?"
Astrid asked.
"Almost nothing," he answered truthfully. "But what I would like to do is get some kind of internet working here in the... in whatever this is."
"It seems we're calling it the Phase."
"Yeah, here in the Phase. I mean, I'd estimate there are 225 or so decent computers based on the number of homes and businesses. The land area is pretty small, so it would be fairly simple to set up Wi-Fi. That's easy. And if I had even a pair of old G5s to work with, I think I could stand up a limited local system."
He smiled happily at the thought.
"That would be great. So, tell me, should I really call you Computer Jack?"
"That's what everyone calls me. Or sometimes just Jack."
"Okay, Jack. What is Kane up to?"
Jack was caught off guard.
"What?
What's he up to? You're a smart kid. You have some idea."
Jack wanted to leave, but he couldn't figure out how to do it. Astrid moved in and put her hand on his arm. He stared down at the hand.
"I know he's up to something,"
Astrid said. Her little brother trained his big, vacant saucer eyes on Jack.
"You know what I think?"
Jack shook his head slowly.
"I think you're a nice person,"
Astrid said.
"I think you're very smart, so people don't always treat you very well. They're scared of your talent, and they try to use you."
Jack caught himself nodding in agreement.
"But I don't think that kid Drake is a nice person." "He's not, is he?"
Jack held very still. He didn't want to give anything away. He was not as quick at understanding people as he was machines. Mostly, people weren't that interesting.
"He's a bully, isn't he? Drake, I mean."
Jack shrugged.
"I thought so. And Kane?"
When Jack didn't answer, Astrid let the question hang there. Jack swallowed and tried to look away, but it wasn't easy.
"Kane,"
Astrid repeated.
"There's something wrong with him, isn't there?"
Computer Jack's resistance crumbled, but not his caution. He lowered his voice to a whisper.
"He can do things,"
Jack said.
"He can..." "Jack, there you are."
Jack and Astrid both jumped. It was Diana Ladris. She nodded cordially at Astrid.
"I hope your little brother is all right. The way you rushed out of there, I thought maybe he was sick."
"No. No, he's fine."
"He's lucky to have you,"
Diana said. As she said it, she took Astrid's hand in hers like she was determined to shake hands. But Jack knew better. Astrid pulled her hand away. Diana had a nice smile, but she didn't use it now. Jack wondered if Diana had been able to finish with Astrid. Probably not. It usually took her longer to read a person's power level. The mood of confrontation was broken by the sound of a diesel engine. It was a kid who looked like he might be Mexican, driving a backhoe down the street.
"Who is that?"
Diana asked.
"Adelio,"
Astrid said.
"What's he doing?"
The boy on the backhoe began to dig a trench, right in the grass of the plaza, close to the sidewalk where the little girl's body lay under its blanket, avoided by all.
"What's he doing?"
Diana repeated.
"I think he's burying the dead,"
Astrid said softly. Diana frowned.
"Kane didn't tell him to do that."
"What does it matter?"
Astrid asked.
"It needed to be done. In fact, I think I'll go and see if I can help. You know, if you think that would be okay with Kane."
Diana didn't smile. She didn't snarl either, and Jack had seen her do that on more than one occasion.
"You seem like a nice girl, Astrid,"
Diana said.
"I'll bet you're one of those brainy Lisa Simpson types, all full of great ideas and worried about saving the planet or whatever. But things have changed. This isn't your old life anymore. It's like... you know what it's like? It's like you used to live in a really nice neighborhood, and now you live in a really tough neighborhood. You don't look tough, Astrid."
"What caused it? The phase? Do you know?"
Astrid demanded, refusing to be intimidated. Diana laughed.
"Aliens. God. A sudden shift in the space-time continuum. I heard someone call you Astrid the Genius, so you've probably thought of explanations I can't even guess at. It doesn't matter. It's happened. Here we are."
"What does Kane want?"
Astrid asked. Jack could not believe Astrid hadn't withered in the face of Diana's confidence. Most people did. Most people couldn't stand up to her. If they did, they were sorry. Jack thought he saw a flicker of appreciation spark Diana's dark eyes.
"What does Kane want? He wants what he wants, and he'll get it,"
Diana said.
"Now run off to the funeral over there. Stay out of my way, and take care of your little brother. Jack?"
The sound of his own name snapped Jack out of his trance.
"Yes? Come."
Jack fell into step behind Diana, ashamed of his instant dog-like obedience. They marched up the steps of the town hall. Kane, to the surprise of no one who knew him, had taken over the mayor's office. He was behind a massive mahogany desk, rocking slowly from side to side in a too-big maroon leather chair.
"Where did you go?"
Kane asked.
"I went to get Jack."
Kane's eyes flickered.
"And where was Computer Jack?"
Diana said,
"Nowhere. He was just wandering. Lost."
She was covering for him, Jack realized with a shock.
"I ran into that girl,"
Diana said.
"The blonde with the strange brother."
"Yes?"
"They call her Astrid the Genius. I think she's involved with that kid, the Fire Kid."
"His name is Sam,"
Kane reminded her.
"I think Astrid's someone we need to keep an eye on."
"Did you read her?"
Kane asked.
"I got a partial read, so I'm not sure."
Kane spread his hands in exasperation.
"Why am I begging for information here? Just tell me."
"She's on about two bars.
Any idea what her powers may be? Lighter? Speeder? Chameleon? Not another Deka, I hope. She was difficult. And hopefully not a reader like you, Diana.
Diana shook her head.
No idea. I'm not even sure she's two bars.
Kane nodded. Then he sighed, as if the weight of the world were on his shoulders.
Put her on the list, Jack. Astrid the Genius, two bars, with a question mark.
Jack pulled out his PDA. It no longer got internet, of course, but its other functions still worked. He punched in the security code and opened the file. The list opened. There were 28 names on it, all Coates kids. In the column after each name was a number, 1, 2, or 3. Only one name had a 4 after it, Kane Sorin. Jack focused on thumbing in the information. Astrid, 2 bars, question mark. He tried not to think about what it meant for the pretty blonde girl.
That went better than I hoped, Kane said to Diana. I predicted there'd be some local bully we'd have to deal with, and I said there would be a natural leader. We get the bully working for us, and we keep an eye on the leader until we're ready to deal with him.
I'll keep an eye on him,
Diana said.
He's cute. Did you get a reading on him?
Jack had seen Diana take Sam's hand, so he was amazed when Diana said,
No, I didn't have a chance.
Jack frowned, uncertain if he should remind Diana. But that was stupid. Of course, Diana would know if she'd read Sam or not.
Do it as soon as you can, Kane said. You saw the way everyone looked at him? And when I asked for nominations, his was the first name mentioned. I don't like it, his being Nurse Temple's son. That's a bad coincidence. Get a read on him. If he has the power, we may not be able to wait to deal with him.
Lana was healed. But she was weak. Hungry. Thirsty. The thirst was the worst thing. She wasn't sure she could stand it. But she had been through hell and survived. And that gave her some reason for hope. The sun was up, but not yet touching her with its rays. The gulch was in the shade. Lana knew that her best chance was to make it back to the ranch before the ground grew as hot as a pie fresh from the oven.
Don't start thinking about food,
she rasped. She was heartened to discover that she still had a voice. She tried to climb straight back up to the road, but 2 skinned knees and 2 abraded palms later, she admitted that wasn't happening. Even Patrick couldn't make the climb. It was just too steep. That left following the ravine until, hopefully, it came out somewhere. It wasn't an easy walk. In most places, the ground was hard, but in other places, it shifted and slid and landed her on hands and knees. Each time she fell, it was harder to get back up. Patrick was panting hard, plodding rather than bounding, just as tired and footsore as she was.
We're in this together, right, boy?
She said. Brush tore at her legs. Rocks bruised her feet. In places, there were thickets of thorn bush that had to be bypassed. In one place, the thorns couldn't be avoided, and she had to work her way through with time-wasting caution, accumulating scratches that burned like fire on her bare legs. But once through, she laid her hand on the scratches, and the pain ebbed. After 10 minutes or so, there was no sign of the scratches. It was miraculous. Lana was convinced of that. She knew she didn't personally have the power to heal dogs or people. She'd never done it before. But how the miracle came about, she did not know. Her mind was on more pressing issues. How to scale this sudden rise, or skirt that bramble patch, or where in this parched landscape she could find water and food. She wished she'd paid a lot more attention to the lay of the land while driving to and from the ranch. Did this gulch head for the ranch, or did it veer past? Was she almost there? Was she now wandering blindly toward the true desert? Was anyone looking for her? The walls of the ravine weren't as tall anymore, but they were just as steep, and closer. The gulch was narrowing. That had to be good news. If it was narrowing and becoming shallower, didn't that mean she must be nearing the end? She had her eyes down on the ground, watching out for snakes, when Patrick stopped, stock still.
"What is it, boy?"
But she saw what it was. There was a wall across the gulch. The wall rose impossibly tall, far higher than the gulch itself, a barrier made of nothing she had ever seen before. Its sheer size, combined with its utter strangeness in this place, struck fear into her. But it didn't seem to be doing anything. It was just a wall. It was translucent, like watery milk. It shimmered just slightly, as if it might be a video effect. It was absurd. Impossible. A wall, where no wall had any business being. She edged closer, but Patrick refused to come along.
"We have to go see what it is, boy,"
she urged. Patrick disagreed. He had no interest in seeing what it was. Up close, she could make out a faint reflection of herself.
"Probably a good thing I can't see myself any better,"
she muttered. Her hair was stiff with dried blood. She knew she was filthy. She could see that her clothing was ripped, and not in an artistic, trendy way, just ripped to ribbons in places. Lana covered the last few feet to the barrier and touched it with one finger.
"Ah!"
She yelped and pulled her finger away. Before the crash, she would have described the pain as searing. Now, she had higher standards for what counted as real pain. But she wouldn't be touching the wall again.
"Some kind of electric fence?"
she asked Patrick.
"What is it doing here?"
There was no choice now but to try to scale the side of the gulch. The problem was that Lana was pretty sure the ranch lay to her left, and that side was impossible to climb. She would have needed a rope and pitons. She figured she could make it up the right side, pushing from tumbled boulder to crumbling ledge. But then, unless she was totally turned around, she'd be placing the gulch between herself and the ranch. The remaining alternative was to head back the way she came. It had taken half the day to get this far. The day would be over before she made it back to her starting point. She would die back where she started.
"Come on, Patrick. Let's get out of here."
It took what felt like an hour to climb the right-hand slope. All the while, under the silent, baleful stare of the wall that Lana had come to think of as a living thing, a vast, malevolent force determined to stop her. When she finally reached the top, she blinked and shaded her eyes and scanned left to right, all the way. That's when she almost fell apart. There was no sign of the road. No sign of the ranch. Just a sheer ridge and no more than a mile of flat land before she would have to start climbing.
And that impossible wall. That impossible, could not be there wall. One way blocked by the gulch, the other by the mountains, the third by the wall that lay across the landscape like it had been dropped out of the sky. The only open path was back the way she had come, back along the narrow strip of flat land that followed the gulch. She shielded her eyes and blinked in the sunlight.
"Wait,"
she said to Patrick.
"There's something there."
Nestled up against the barrier, not far from the foot of the mountains, was it really a patch of green, shimmering in the rising heat waves? It had to be a mirage.
"What do you think, Patrick?"
Patrick was indifferent. The spirit had gone from the dog. He was in no better shape than she was herself.
"I guess a mirage is all we have,"
Lana said. They set off together. At least it was easier than the climb up out of the gulch. But the sun was like a hammer now, beating down on Lana's unprotected head. She could feel her body giving up, even as her spirit was tortured by doubt. She was chasing a mirage with the last of her strength. She would die chasing a stupid mirage. But the green patch did not disappear. It grew slowly larger as they closed the distance. Lana's consciousness was a flickering candle now, in and out, alert for a few seconds, then lost in a formless dream. Lana staggered, feet dragging, half-blind from the relentless glare of the sun, when she realized that her foot had stepped from dust onto grass. Her toes registered the sponginess of the grass. It was a minuscule lawn, 12 feet by 12 feet. In the center was a back-and-forth sprinkler. It was not turned on, but a hose led from the sprinkler. The hose led around a small, windowless, wooden cabin. It wasn't much of a cabin, no bigger than a single room. Behind the cabin was a half-tumbled wooden shack, and a windmill of sorts, really just an airplane propeller placed atop a ramshackle tower 20 feet tall. Lana staggered along the hose, following it to its source. It came from a once-painted, now sandblasted, steel tank, elevated on a platform of railroad ties beneath the makeshift windmill. A rusty pipe jutted up from the ground beneath the windmill. There were valves and connecting pipes. The hose came to an end at a faucet welded into the end of the tank.
"It's a well, Patrick."
Lana fumbled frantically with weak fingers at the hose connection. It came off. She twisted the knob, and it turned. Water, hot and smelling of minerals and rust, came gushing. Lana drank. Patrick drank. She let the water flow over her face, let it wash the blood from her face, let it soften her crusted hair. But she had not come this far to let her salvation drain away for a momentary pleasure. She twisted the knob shut again. The last drop quivered on the brass lip, and she took it on her fingertip and used it to clean the crust from her bloodied eye. Then, for the first time in forever, she laughed.
"We're not dead yet, are we, Patrick?"
Lana said.
"Not yet."
16. 171 hours, 12 minutes.
"You have to boil the water first, then you put in the pasta," Quinn said.
"How do you know that?"
Sam was frowning,
turning a blue box of Rotini around, trying to find instructions. Because I've seen my mom do it, like, a million times. The water has to start boiling first. Sam and Quinn stared at the big pot of water on the stove. "A watched pot never boils," Adelio said. Sam and Quinn both looked away. Adelio laughed.
"He's just a saying. It's not actually true."
"I knew that," Sam said. Then he laughed. "Okay, I didn't know it." "Maybe you can just zap it up with your magic hands," Quinn suggested. Sam ignored him. He found Quinn's teasing on that front annoying. The firehouse was a two-story cinder-block cube. Down below was the garage that housed the fire engine and the ambulance. The second floor was the living area, a large room that encompassed a kitchen, an oblong dining table, and a mismatched pair of couches. A door led to a separate, narrow room lined with bunk beds, space for six people. The main room was almost, but not quite, cheerful. There were photos of firefighters, some in stiff, formal poses, some goofing with their buddies. There were letters of thanks from various people, including illustrated letters from the first grade class visit that all began with "Dear Firefighter," although the spelling was sometimes mysterious. There was a large round table that had displayed the remains of an abruptly abandoned poker game. Fallen hands of cards, chips, cigars in ashtrays, when the three of them first arrived, but had since been cleaned off. And there was a surprisingly well-stocked pantry. Jars of tomato sauce, cans of soup, boxes of pasta. There was a red lacquered can of homemade cookies, now pretty stale, but not inedible if you microwaved them for 15 seconds. Sam had accepted the assignment as fire chief. Not because he wanted to, but because so many other people seemed to want him to. He hoped no one would call on him to actually do anything, because after 3 days in the firehouse, the three of them still barely knew how to start the fire engine, let alone drive it anywhere or do anything with it. The one time a kid had come rushing up yelling, "Fire!" Sam, Quinn, and Adelio had half-carried, half-dragged a hose and a hydrant wrench 6 blocks, only to discover that the kid's brother had microwaved a can. The smoke was just from a burned-out microwave oven. But, on the plus side, they knew where to find all the emergency supplies in the ambulance. And they had practiced with the big hose and the hydrant outside so they could be quicker and more efficient than Adelio had been at the first fire. And they had totally mastered the fireman's pole. "We're out of bread," Adelio said. "Don't need bread if you have pasta," Sam said. "They're both carbs."
"Who's talking about nutrition? You're supposed to have bread with a meal."
"I thought your people ate tortillas," Quinn said.
"Tortillas are bread."
"Well, we have no bread," Sam said.
"Not of any kind."
"In another week or so, no one will have any bread," Quinn pointed out. "Bread has to be made fresh, you know. It gets moldy after a while."
3 days had passed since Kane and his posse had swept into town and basically taken over. 3 days with no one arriving to rescue them. 3 days of deepening depression. 3 days of growing acceptance that, for now at least, this was life. And the phase itself, everyone called it that now, was 5 days old. 5 days with no adults. 5 days without mothers, fathers, big brothers and sisters, teachers, police officers, store clerks, pediatricians, clergy, dentists. 5 days without television, internet, or phones. Kane had been welcomed at first.
People wanted to know that someone was in charge. People wanted there to be answers. People wanted rules. Cain was very good at establishing his authority. Each time Sam had dealt with him, he came away impressed at the way Cain could act with complete confidence, as if he had been born to the job. But already, in just 3 days, doubts had grown, too. The doubts centered on Cain and Diana, but more still on Drake Merwin. Some kids argued you needed someone a little scary around to make sure rules were obeyed. Other kids agreed with that, but pointed out that Drake was more than a little scary. Kids who defied Drake, or any of his so-called sheriffs, had been slapped, punched, pushed, knocked down, or, in one case, dragged into a bathroom and given a swirly. Fear of Drake was replacing fear of the unknown.
"I can make tortillas fresh," Adelio said. "I just need flour, a little shortening, salt, baking powder. We have all that here."
"Save it for taco night," Quinn said.
He took the pasta from Sam and dumped it into the pot. Adelio frowned.
"You hear something?"
Sam and Quinn froze. The loudest sound was the boiling water. Then they all heard it. A voice, wailing. Sam took 3 steps to the fireman's pole, wrapped his legs and arms around it, and dropped through the hole in the floor to land in the garishly lit garage below. The garage was open to the evening air. Someone, a girl, judging by the long reddish hair, was slumped on the threshold, looking like she might be trying to crawl, moving but not really going anywhere. 3 figures advanced up the driveway from the street.
"Help me,"
the girl pleaded softly. Sam knelt beside her. He recoiled in shock.
"Bet?"
The left side of Bouncing Bet's face was covered in blood. There was a gash above her temple. She was panting, gasping, like she had collapsed after a marathon and was trying with her last ounce of energy to crawl across the finish line.
"Bet, what happened?"
"They're trying to get me,"
Bet cried, and clutched at Sam's arm. The 3 dark figures advanced to the edge of the circle of light. One was clearly Orc. No one else was that big. Adelio and Quinn moved into the garage doorway. Sam disengaged from Bet and took up a position beside Adelio.
"You want me to beat on you guys, I will,"
Orc yelled.
"What's going on here?"
Sam demanded. He narrowed his eyes and recognized the other 2 boys, a kid named Carl, a 7th grader from school, and Chaz, one of the Coates 8th graders. All 3 were armed with aluminum bats.
"This isn't your business," Chaz said. "We're dealing with something here."
"Dealing with what? Orc, did you hit Bet?"
"She was breaking the rules,"
Orc said.
"You hit a girl, man?" Adelio said, outraged.
"Shut up, wetback,"
Orc said.
"Where's Howard?"
Sam asked, just to stall while he tried to figure out what to do. He'd lost 1 fight to Orc already. Orc took the question as an insult.
"I don't need Howard to handle you, Sam."
Orc marched right up to Sam, stopped 1 foot away, and put his bat on his shoulder like he was ready to swing for a home run. Like a batter ready for the next fastball. Only this was closer to T-ball. Sam's head was impossible to miss.
"Move, Sam,"
Orc ordered.
"Okay, I'm not doing this again," Quinn said. "Let him have her, Sam."
"Ain't no let me,"
Orc said.
"I do what I want."